be Saturday?
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falconstein from Falcon Screen, and we are joined by Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans.
Hey, guys.
The regular penance to Virat Nehru is abroad at the moment, but he'll be joining us back in a couple of weeks. Looking forward to having Virat back in the studio. Later in the program, we will be talking Guns Akimbo, which has a special screening on Friday night and is in general release from the following week, as well as The Invisible Man, the new Lee Whannell film, now that the embargo is over. And it is in cinemas from tomorrow. However, first up, the Fantastic Film Festival Australia is in full swing over at the Randwick Ritz. It is running through until March 2nd, and we have the festival director Hudson Sawada with us to talk all things Fantastic Film Festival Australia. Hudson, thank you so much for joining us.
It is my absolute pleasure, guys. So excited to be having a chat with you today.
We're just excited that this is happening. It's the first time it's happened in Sydney. It's a new festival. It's always exciting. Can you tell us, Fantastic Film Festival Australia, what is it? What is it all about?
Yeah, totally. So the festival is an event dedicated to artists and filmmakers who are working on really, I guess, the fringes of cinema, those who are challenging the status quo, creating highly unique and, I guess, really authentic pieces of outsider cinema, and with a real focus on people with a distinct perception of reality or something to say about the something political or social or something really personal, all with, a bit of a slight twist. You could see it as that. And really, these films, while a lot of them kind of fit into, I guess, genre elements, you know, horror, sci-fi, you know, fantasy kind of cinema, are really what at the core of the event it is. It's dedicated to those with a questioning eye and a really unique attitude to filmmaking. So, we've got an incredibly diverse range of films, 25 Australian premieres, which are range from, you know, solo animation projects, really minimalist films, or some of them are, you know, really hard-boiled horror films and crime titles. There's some great thrillers and really just something that you really never get the opportunity to see in Australia, a lot of these titles, let alone with a cinema audience. So we're incredibly excited to be bringing them to Sydney.
Did the idea for the programming start off as a more genre-based approach and then broaden, or were you always open to all sorts of different programming? Because it is, it's quite an interesting mix.
Most definitely. So it actually started in 2018, I guess, the mindset of the festival, with an event we ran in Melbourne called Paris Cinema Fest. And Paris Cinema is it's a term that was coined in the 90s to describe an attitude to filmmaking that is about supporting transgressive films, counterculture ideas, and people who are really, pushing the limits of cinema without necessarily having the resources or the facilities or the training to kind of really to kind of make it in the scene. So it's really about supporting, that festival is really about supporting those kinds of films and those ideas, and looking at films that maybe, you know, have scaffolding still to show, and supporting those artists. So from that event, we looked at what we did and what was really working and what was really exciting, and then came back at Fantastic Fest Australia with that same kind of attitude, but with more of a spin that was approachable and inclusive of all kinds of really interesting auteur filmmakers and people who are really pushing what we can put up on screen. So I guess that's kind of where the mindset came from. And then as, you know, I was programming this film festival over the last, it's taken about 9 months to get it to the way it is now. A lot of the titles, as they would come, you'd watch them and you'd have to think, does this fit into the attitude that I'm wanting to put across? And there's a couple of key titles that I'm sure we'll go into in more detail shortly, but Chained for Life was the first film that we programmed. And it really spoke to this mindset of using genre and genre themes to really explore complex and political and really personal issues. And Chained for Life is really about who gets to make films and what limited stories we get access to, especially when it comes to disability and an industry focused on beauty. So that really set the tone for the event. And then a film like Aren't You Happy, which is this bubblegum romp with a big band soundtrack that's just a deconstruction of so much political writing just amazing. That film that wouldn't fit into any traditional genre categories really was a perfect, fantastic attitude. So, yeah, I guess as we were kind of going, we were trying to figure out what mindset we wanted to kick the event off, and that's kind of how it came about.
So I was at the screening the other night, Chain for Life, the Australian premiere, the opening of the festival, and I'm picking up on some of the things you said. Yes, it deals with ideas of beauty and representation, but also ideas of exploitation and when this can be seen or how this can be avoided or how it can be even unintentionally evoked within cinema. I'm very curious in your perspective of that, but also how some of the other films, particularly in the festival, try to address this trend or try to address what is a very broad and quite an often contentious issue within cinema.
Yes, yes, that's exactly right. And often there are contradictions in themes, and not all the films really are super, I guess, safe in some ways. We have a film, Golden Glove, which is the most challenging title, no doubt, in the program, that I think will really affect a lot of people, both in ways that they expected and didn't expect it.
I remember the reviews being mostly of horror or disgust when that premiered at Berlin.
Yes, and that's when I watched it after it released in Berlin, which was booed and walked out, and it was an incredibly infamous screening. But then now the film has had a bit of life and has really kind of come into its own in the genre festival, and it was famous, well, relatively recently, the Fantastic Fest in the U.S., the director's favorite film of the festival, and it really got an incredibly well-received screenings over there. So I guess that kind of
mainstream crowd isn't necessarily open to some of the more challenging. Well, calling the festival crowd mainstream isn't quite right, but it's its own little box, I think, with its own expectations and its own conventions.
That's right, and you kind of have to give it just a little bit of context, I think, and to just kind of go into that a lot. Well, some of these films to just go in, without necessarily being put in a certain kind of festival or a certain kind of environment can really affect, I think, the experience of it, where if you're going into the screening with a bunch of other people who are really interested in cinema that is not by the grain, I think it'll be a different kind of, not to say that it's going to be for everybody, but I think there are certainly titles that work really well in a genre environment and with a genre crowd that may not do so elsewhere.
Are you here on Film Fight Club with Glenn Fowlkes and Chris Evans, and we're talking all things Fantastic Film Festival Australia at the Ritz Cinema with Festival Director Hassan Sawada. So, as you said, there are 25 Australian premieres. A lot of them have often more tours. They're very genre-based, and many have, to this end, quite explicit content. A lot of the films have content warnings. However, I noticed there are two films in the program which do not. They're both animations, and one I was very happy to catch the other day, a Latvian film. And I'm wondering, these films in particular, what do you believe that establishes them as fantastic and contributes to in a very different aesthetic and form to the rest of the fantastic program?
Yeah, definitely. So fantastic cinema, the fantastic cinema mindset is often kind of deals with extremes, you know, like people who are pushing it to the extremes of graphic content, or whether it be in the form of violence or language or tone or aesthetic, really. So they kind of push what the possibilities of film can kind of be about. So in that nature, often there are moments of graphic nature, and even though there's a lot of films highlighted as such, many of those only maybe have one or two sequences that maybe consider it to have that warning. But those two animations are no less extreme in their ambition. You know, as you've seen, Away, it really is this tour de force of this filmmaker who's made this entire film completely by themselves as an animator, and it really is this amazing piece of minimalist filmmaking that is definitely still full of the ambition of the other fantastic films that we've got in the program. So I think it really suits the kind of atmosphere of the festival and of the creators that we're trying to showcase. And the same goes with She, the film that is a stop motion animation, again made pretty much by one artist over 5 years, that encompasses all kinds of really political themes about sex and you know, workplace discrimination and especially poignant the fact that it's a Chinese film as well, and the role of gender in the workplace over there. So each of these films, while you know they may not have traditional content warnings, so to speak, they're no less incredibly powerful and I guess, yeah, ambitious, extreme films. And She-He will leave the audience reeling with the insanity that ensues on the screen. I've truly seen nothing like any of these films really in the program.
Now, the other night, Chris and I were at the Ritz. We were there for the Fantastic, and I caught a double, Horror Noir, to date my favorite film of the festival, and we caught together
Zombie Child.
Yeah. And we're curious to talk about these two films, but also I noticed there are a number of pairings throughout the festival, and this was a particular one that stood out.
Yeah, definitely. So we were really lucky to come across both of these films and be able to program them together, because Horror Noir is a film about the history of African-American artists in Hollywood genre cinema, and it starts at really the birth of American cinema at Birth of a Nation, which is kind of set the stage really on the way Black actors and characters are treated in cinema as being either villains or servants or other kinds of really sidelined and misrepresented people, really. And then throughout the cinema, American cinema history, it's kind of spilled out into different kinds of, I guess, attitudes. And then closing with, the Get Out and Jordan Peele's fantastic new films that are really changing the scene. So, and I think it really gives people a really great lens, like any kind of film class, a lens where you can go back and look at films or continue to view films with a particular attitude, I think, that really can contextualize things in a different way. And Horror Noir talks a lot about the treatment of voodoo and voodoo culture in horror films and how inappropriately it's often used. And Zombie Child was a really great example of how voodoo can be reclaimed and zombie, mythos can be used to explore incredibly deep and meaningful themes on racial oppression and colonialization through generations. So it was an incredibly smart film, Zombie Child, in the way it used split timeline between a real-world Haitian case of voodoo zombie slavery and his granddaughter kind of living in a highly, prestigious school, and the way that the colonial oppression of France has kind of rippled through and the attitudes that have come through that. So I think watching those two back-to-back can kind of be a little bit more of an enlightening cinema experience that I really hope that people got to experience the other day.
Zombie Child strikes me as the kind of film that a festival like this is built for, because it's the kind of slow, arty, European auteur cinema film that would maybe usually play at Sydney Film Festival, but I think the genre twist there would turn people off. So it's like, where is the place for this kind of film if there aren't specialty festivals like Fantastic Fest to create a space for them?
Well, yeah, I'm so glad you said that, because I felt that there's a lot of films like that in here that don't necessarily fit into that real kind of intense kind of slasher horror kind of theme, but often, yeah, again, they don't fit into more of the more general and mainstream film festivals. So I think they fit in a fantastic little pocket that we can contextualize together. Yeah,
I think so. We're big fans here on the show of the Sydney Underground Film Festival.
Of course,
they do great work, but their programming tends to go into extremes, either in terms of gore or just being really outrageously wacky. So it's good to have a space for something that doesn't necessarily fit with their mandate.
Yeah, fantastic program as well at the Sydney Underground. They've got some amazing curators. So, yeah, really excited to share the love for underground cinema at both events. And, so it's really nice of you to enjoy what we're doing. That means a lot.
It's good to see more of these festivals popping up. I think it's probably a case where a rising tide helps lift all the boats. Anything that gets more people going to the cinema.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because these films, as I'm sure you guys have experienced, they're just really made for the cinema, a lot of them. They're really like ones that work so well with, you know, in a dark room with so much focus and energy and being with other people and just watching them on a computer just doesn't really do a lot of these films justice. So, yeah, really, really excited that people have been enjoying them.
No, it's something much better to experience on as big a screen as possible, as is one of my very favourite genres, which I see underrepresented in cinema, but I see quite well represented at this festival, which is psychological dramas, poached psychological thrillers. We referred to Zombie Child earlier. I call it Suicide Tourist. I think it goes in both veins. It is predominantly a psychological drama, and it seems that there's a lot of these types of films that have been prioritised. This is, again, underappreciated genre, which has been prioritised throughout the festival.
Yeah, that's right. Suicide Tourist, again, uses, it stars Nikolai Coster-Waldau of Game of Thrones, Jamie Lannister fan. It's so great to see him in something with his native tongue.
And that ends well.
Yeah. I love the ending. And it uses genre tropes in such an intelligent and human way. You know, it really showed, it's a real masterclass in how to use genre effectively and use human emotion to really sell what they're trying to do, and it never becomes pretentious. It never becomes pretentious and retains its classy nature. So yeah, really excited to premiere that one in Australia.
So with just 4 days left in the festival, what films would you recommend that are still left to screen?
Yeah, well, like we were talking about earlier, each of the films kind of really, I think, captures a different kind of cinema sensibility. So there really is something for all kinds of tastes, whether it be genre or more psychological drama or really just animation or beautiful or to a cinema. So what day are we on now? We've still got some amazing films coming up in the next few days, like Climate of the Hunter tonight is a really amazing example of true American auteur filmmaking. That is just this beautiful mismatch of great, you know, 60s and 70s looking cinema with a vampire twist and with two fantastic leads. So that one's really excited to be screening that. And then afterwards, we've got Diner, which is this ridiculous film about a diner for assassins that just feels like this beautiful music video with incredible choreography and really, it's just like a John Wick meets an anime, like a Japanese anime. So that one is a really exciting film. But really, the other titles that a must kind of check out is on Thursday, we've got a Q&A screening with Sons of Steel, a lost heavy metal sci-fi musical, one of the last of the exploitation films in Australia that kind of was lost to time and may or may not be becoming a Netflix series coming up soon. So really is one to watch with the director and the cast and crew on Thursday, and then followed by a Q&A of Homewrecker, a great Canadian horror comedy, and the director's flown all the way from Canada to have a chat to our audience. So that one's a really exciting one not to miss. I would also really, really suggest checking out St. Maud, if those who haven't seen it yet. That one, it really is a great example of a debut filmmaker coming out fully formed with a great psychological drama and thriller that, about space, salvation, and that.
And that's an A24 release, is that right?
Yes, that's right. It's A24's latest film. We've got the Australian premiere. It's likely to get a cinema run in a couple of months, but yeah, really wanted to see with a big audience and be the first to see it in the country.
And we do have the Golden Glove on Friday for those who are game.
Indeed. So yeah, but that is all happening at the Ritz. So come check it out. We'll be there. Hudson, it's been so great to chat. We're looking forward to catching some more movies with you.
Thank you so much for your time tonight, guys. I hope you enjoy the rest of the festival.
Thank you.
And you're on Film Fight Club with Glenn and Chris, and we are talking The Invisible Man, the new film from Saws, Lee Whannell, Australia's own.
Saw, yeah.
And Insidious, and Upgrade, which we covered to great acclaim 2 years ago.
Yeah, this is only his second film as a director. Upgrade was the first. And
this is an upgrade?
I would say this is an upgrade over Upgrade, and Upgrade was already a very promising start.
One of my very favourite action scenes from a couple of years back. This is starring Elizabeth Moss, Aldous Hodge, Harriet Dyer, and Adrian Jackson-Cohen. It is not based very much on the classic H.G. Wells novel, one of my very favourites when I was a child.
Beyond having a invisible villain who murderous, that's it.
There is one wry illusion involving a coat rack, but it was actually quite funny. Well, it's not funny, it was wry, I should say. It was a good illusion for classic genre fans. This is a Hollywood film filmed in Australia, but set in somewhere in America, ostensible. Yeah. Just we're at the point now where Australia can double for America with production offsets and looks broadly like America.
Well, on the podcast, we'll be covering a film where New Zealand doubles for America. I think anywhere can be America now.
Anyway, yeah, it works. Chicago is actually filmed in Canada. But anyway, we're getting sidetracked. This is about Cecilia, the Elizabeth Moss character, who in the opening scenes of the film escapes from her abusive partner, played by Adrian Jackson Cohen, who is a world optics expert. We see the fallout from this, and soon we found out that her partner has died. And however, there is she has a concern that an invisible presence is in her life and affecting her life and following her around, and things progress from there. I really enjoy this film on balance. I think it's one of the better films. It's certainly one of the better genre action flicks I've seen this year. Certainly a lot of it depends on the quality of the technical craft, and I think Winnell in particular excels at this juncture.
Yeah, I think this is one of the better Hollywood releases in a while, including all the Oscar bait. I thought this was a really fun B-movie, and I agree that it's Leigh Whannell as the director that really elevates it. He's so good with the camera. Once again, as in Upgrade, the camera is kind of mimicking the presence that's driving the action. In Upgrade, there was some really creative camera flipping all over the place stuff that managed not to be a gimmick, but to be tied to the action. Here, we've got the camera as the villain, as this kind of lingering presence. There's a lot of dread mined out of these long shots held from a distance. At first, before the B-movie plot mechanics really get underway, it gave me a similar vibe to some of the art horror movies of recent years, like Hereditary, where it's just the dread of really long, sustained shots where you get the sense that something's wrong or that there's an evil presence.
There's nothing, I enjoyed a lot of this film, there's nothing as entertaining or engaging to me though as the first act, where the camera just lingers around the apartment and you're left to wonder, along with the main character, what is going on, what is here, is there a specter of some sort? On the B-movie aspects of it, I actually don't really classify this mostly as a B-film, in part because of production values, but also because it follows a strong internal logic. I would diverge from that when it comes to a later stage in the film. I think, unlike Upgrade, when the film does go to its B-movie roots and there is a departure in logic towards the conclusion, it doesn't devolve the film, but it takes away somewhat from it.
There are some stretches in credulity. There are some moments that the film asks you to just accept that I had some difficulty doing.
Yeah, and there's nothing on Upgrade, likewise, at a twist ending, but that was clever and intrinsic to the plot and character. This was more of a aha, we gotcha moment, and is never as good as the equivalent aha gotcha moments where you don't quite know, is someone here, is something here? And then it proceeds into monster territory a la Jaws and another film where you
Aliens.
Have to discern when the monster's here, and then you ultimately have to confront it. This will be taught in a lot of screenwriting classes. It has a pretty standard three-act structure in that regard, but I liked it.
Very tight.
Very tight.
On the subject of its writing, though, I really appreciate that it had the courage to be quite an expansive plot with some twists and turns that goes to some places that you might not expect from the get-go. It could have easily just been a very contained thriller. And in some way, I think that would have been cheaper and safer than what it goes for, which is this big grand narrative, even though it gets silly, as we were saying, towards the end.
Yeah, there's without ruining anything, jumps in logic. I think the supporting cast also add a lot to this film. Harriet Dyer, in Australia's own Harriet Dyer, who really liked in Killing Ground. She plays a great character, does it well. Certainly, her character's function plays a pivotal role in elevating this film. Aldous Hodge, he played a pretty standard, stock standard, nice, good, tough cop. But having said that, he did it quite well. My favorite character in this, however, I've got to bring up his name, the brother of the main character, of the surviving brother of the invisible man, who for a B movie was quite a multi-dimensional character.
His role in the plot leaves you guessing and leaves you unsure. There's a lot of aspects of just the writing and the direction that build up such a sense of dread and confusion, which I think is appropriate given the subject matter that the film is going for. This is really, I think, one of the first big post-Me Too horror films.
Yes. Now, turning to this aspect of it, the film very clearly is a commentary on Me Too and like movements, where it talks about the fallacy of not believing women who state that they have been victims of abuse and violence. However, I think it has a very progressive overall message in this regard. However, I think we have to be clear, the film does not pursue this message exclusively. There is a sequence, there's not a criticism, more of an observation. There is a sequence where we see a female character who is not the main character assaulted, and in such a way that people believe it is the fault of another character. We and this character know this very much not to be the case, but it is not entirely in the oeuvre of you must believe persons in the circumstance. It does present a circumstance where this certainly is not the case.
I don't think the film's designed to be a very strict, rigid Me Too analogy. More that it's just sort of echoing the ideas that are being brought to people's consciousness more about domestic abuse. I think, we've got the Invisible Man here as a neat metaphor, I think, for dealing with lingering after impacts of trauma and with, the confusion surrounding gaslighting, a force that someone is so sure is there, but it's hard to convince other people. I thought it was a very neat little metaphor, and you can feel the rage behind it.
Yeah, on this matter, we've talked in the past on the show about how important it is to depict these sorts of issues in a sensitive way, and that may mean not necessarily depicting the abuse graphically. I think at the outset of the film handles it very well. We see her escaping from this figure, and we see the aftermath. We see her suffering post-traumatic stress disorder. We see the impact of this abuse, which is most significant, rather than outlining or making explicit or graphic the abuse itself.
I actually really appreciated that. I think it was better left to the imagination, and it wasn't necessary to go into the details of her abuse. I think everyone watching this film would get the idea.
And a lot of this is carried in large part due to Elizabeth Moss, who's always been a fantastic performer and carries these scenes and all things exceptionally well. I can't fault a performance in this movie.
Agreed.
Having said that, there is a sequence later in the film where involving abuse, where I don't believe. This necessarily merits an inclusion. I think it was intended to further our understanding of the character's motivation. But having said that, we already understand the character's motivation very clearly. And in this circumstance, when this instance of abuse happens, we aren't treated to the extent we are earlier at understanding of the impact and the fallout. I don't think this merits the film not being seen. I think it is a fault of the film, but overall, I do think the film takes a progressive and good approach to this earlier on. I wish that sort of approach to post-traumatic stress disorder had been emulated later in the film, as it had been earlier in the movie. But overall, I was very impressed with how Winnell and the team handled this dimension. I also don't think this ventures into the realm of exploitation, because tragically, the event depicted as something that, in the context of this universe, can very much transpire. And I will finally say on this matter that a lot of films do not put a female protagonist front and center when dealing with these sorts of issues, or put a male protagonist. And this is a film that does not do that. And there is obviously a very strong focus on Cecilia throughout, and I appreciate that. It's something a lot of Hollywood fare does not manage or pursue.
Yeah, I think the plot element towards the end of the film that Glenn is talking about, it definitely is questionable in terms of how necessary it was, even though, as we were discussing off-air, it does make sense within the context of this universe, and it's definitely effective as a plot element in terms of forcing the hand of several characters in the narrative. It just comes down to a question of taste, I think, really. But as a whole, I agree with Glenn that I think the film is definitely on the side of victims and of women who are abused, and tries to find a big genre horror movie way of expressing a lot of the internal turmoil people in these survivor situations face.
Now, these are very serious issues we have talked about on the show, and if you want to discuss these sorts of issues with anyone, we certainly encourage you to reach out and do so. And 1-800-RESPECT is a great helpline for this and a great service. The number is 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732. That's 1-800-737-732. We're going to be continuing on the podcast talking all things Guns Akimbo. Next week, we'll be discussing Dark Waters, as well as other things that are happening in the world of cinema.
We'll figure it out before next week.
we promise we will. The Lee Winnell's The Invisible Man is in cinemas from tomorrow, and the Fantastic Film Festival Australia is at the Randwick until March 2nd. And if you're listening from Melbourne, it's playing at Melbourne's Lido Cinema until March 4th. And there's a few great screenings coming up, so do seek it out.
Yeah, there's also, starting on from Wednesday at 2 p.m., when the episode we do, the day our next episode comes out, The new series at the Art Gallery of New South Wales about fakes and deceptions comes out, starting with Orson Welles' great film essay, F for Fake.
And go see Japanese Supernatural. It's in there too. It's really good.
Yeah, it's about to end.
So this has been Glenn Falkenstein and Chris Evans. Rutney will join us in the subsequent week. Have a wonderful night. Stay tuned for The Sonic Assassin. Enjoy movies. Good night.
Bye.
And we are on the Film Fight Club podcast, talking all things Guns Akimbo. This is getting a special screening thanks to Monster Fest and Monster Pictures on Friday night all around the country, and is in general release from the following week. So we're going to be talking about this film. It stars Daniel Radcliffe and is the second directorial feature from Deathgasm's Jason Lee Howden. Now, we need to address a controversy that has come about online in the past few days. So what is a broad summary of this is that the director Jason Lee Howden has reportedly made some tweets which Mad Men, the film's distributor, has characterized as unacceptable, and subsequent statement regarding his reported criticism of what he reportedly termed cyberbullying and bullying. The Mad Men, and those tweets, as I understand, at the time of recording are no longer available online. Mad Men released a statement saying that the Mad Men found this behavior unacceptable, but intend to release the film because hundreds of people worked on this feature. We agree. We have certainly expressed that sort of sentiment in the past regards to other films where there has been other controversies. So we plan to cover review of this film. On a personal note, I actually had done an interview with Jason Lee Howden and had intended to publish it. I sought clarification from the group who got in contact with me to arrange the interview, and I did not receive a clarification that would make me satisfied to publish the interview. Therefore, I've decided not to publish the interview with Jason Lee Howden and effectively promote him, given his reported immediate behavior, which again may have turned unacceptable, but we are going to be covering Guns Akimbo. Guns Akimbo is starring Daniel Radcliffe and Samara Weaving. It is set currently in, also it is filmed in New Zealand, which looks very much like America, and is
well
about
disguised, just well, like the Invisible Man that we yeah. just spoke about, disguised.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's filmed somewhere else, but predominantly in New Zealand, predominantly around Auckland.
Germany as well, I think.
Germany, actually. Yes, right. It was filmed in Germany.
Yeah.
And it is about an internet troll played by Radcliffe, who's a massive loner, and then gets taken away by a group called Schism, who enjoy putting trolls and people in terrible situations for people's online viewing.
Usually it's not trolls. Usually it's just we pit criminals against each other in a real-life first-person shooter, and we stream it with drones that fly around following the action.
Yeah, think of what's the Black Mirror Season 2 episode where they take all the people, where they White have Bear. Drones follow, no, they have drones follow Bronn from Game of Thrones around, and the guy from It's Only the End of the World, and so that if you don't do these tasks, then we release your online behavior.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's very much, it riffs off a few Black Mirror tropes. It's certainly The Truman Show, and it has these people following him around. He wakes up, finds guns are surgically affixed to his hands, he has 100 bullets, and he has to fight the Samara Weaving character, Nyx, in order to survive, and all these exploits are followed on camera. It is also starring Flight of the Conchords, Rhys Darby in a minor
crack
role.
Addict.
It's a crack addict. And it has an extremely strong video game aesthetic. Certainly as we see Radcliffe's character's bullets deplete, there's a counter on the screen. You've gone from 198 very much like you would see in a video game, and suddenly the action progresses like a typical video game.
Okay, so what kind of gun does Daniel Radcliffe have affixed to his hands?
Which
that, it has like 50 bullets in it.
It's a big magazine.
That's a huge magazine for a handgun. Handgun, haha. But he can't. But he never says, "Can I reload this? Is there a place that sells ammo?"
Yeah, a lot.
Does it hold 50 bullets, but no reloads ever?
Well, is the bit with the magazine affixed to the palm of his hand, so he can't reload it?
Yeah, the whole selling point of this movie was like it's like the gun hands guy. So I would have liked to like get into the mechanics of how the gun hand thing works.
Yeah, to be clear, like it's drilled into his hands. A lot of the intended visual humor of this film is him trying to do things like go to the toilet or
pick up his phone
or his pants.
His pants,
he's wearing
yeah.
a dressing gown and slippers basically yeah. throughout the entirety of the movie.
And look, some of that humor is amusing with the guns connected to his hands, but beyond the physical comedy there was nothing justifying the main selling point, the main image from the film. The action scenes would work just as well if it's a guy holding two guns. Like there was no point where they thought up a creative angle for the action revolving around a guy with guns connected to his hands. So the premise could have been just as well have been, you are now registered in the game and here are two guns. Like, I know the guns affixed to his hands makes it hard for him to do stuff, but you expect there's going to be some kind of twist on action. And no, I haven't thought of any ideas. Maybe there are no ideas, but I didn't write a movie called Guns Akimbo.
Yeah, I think the intent is more around the visual humor of having this restriction on him. Yeah. We should also note that I think we watched this film in very different contexts.
That's true, yes. Glenn probably watched it in the ideal state, which is very drunk.
At 11:30 on a Saturday night and just like, Guns Akimbo. This sounds
Guns Akimbo on.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I was very sober for this. Probably too sober. I just found this lacking in original ideas. And I found it really smug and self-satisfied in the tone and really, really unfunny. It's kind of doing the Scott Pilgrim thing with the on-screen video game graphics and the music and, you know, the one-up sound effects and things like that synced to the action, but it doesn't have the wit that Edgar Wright brings to the visuals. As an action movie, I thought it was pretty poorly shot. It's got this hyperactive flipping all over the place camera, which I think is meant to show the disorientated state of Daniel Radcliffe's character at a few points, but it's too much. Like, it just feels too affected. I thought the action is just, there's too much of it. It's too frenetic. It's kind of exhausting. And a lot of the time, it doesn't feel like it's playing to the clearly low budget of the film. So there are these big CGI-style action set pieces that end up just looking cheap. I found the jokes often really bad. The Rhys Darby from Flight of the Conchords is funny, but the way his character is written... He's barely in it, but the way his character is written for me just epitomizes... I don't know. The unfunniness was extreme. It's such a nerd movie, and I think I'm just over the whole nerd subculture. It's like, it's a movie about like how cool it is, like heads blowing up and brains splattering on things, and it's always cool, except for when it's sad, you know, when it has to be for the plot. And there's all these, it's like Scott Pilgrim in terms of all the pop culture references, except it's been updated to contemporary internet memes, so it's more insufferable. The world of it makes no sense, right? Like, there's an active police force, which may or may not be compromised, but it seems like some of the police are actually chasing some of the people involved in this game. It seems pretty easy to put a stop to schism based on what we see in the movie, but for some reason they're able to operate without being stopped by the police. I don't know. I'm giving it probably more thought than it was ever designed to hold up to.
All right, so you've covered a lot of what you don't like about this film. I'm going to talk about a few things I didn't like about it and then talk about what I did like about it. I appreciate that a lot of this film is repetitive. The action sequences and also the way they are shot are samey. It is a bit of a one gimmick. Oh, you have guns attached to your hands. Having said that, I did like the visual humor and how it was deployed and some of the things Radcliffe has to do. I think the stars really elevate this. I really like Radcliffe, and particularly weaving in this film. I think she's best in show. I referred to Darby earlier. Radcliffe has this, you know, fish out of water. Oh, what have I done? And you certainly see his arc develop throughout the movie as he is unclearly nonplussed and then becomes gradually more confident as he's forced to fight out of these situations. Weaving, I've always enjoyed her performances. This may be my favorite of hers to date. I liked her in The Babysitter and some of the other stuff she's done. Certainly, she transformed, I think, a lot more in this than she has in other performances. And I think it's making broad strokes in terms of political commentary. I know films like Black Mirror, The Truman Show go into a lot more detail, but I did like what this ultimately had to say about cyberbullying. It talks about how there is a negativity to how online treatment and how conflicts and things can pan out online.
I think, you know, at this point we all kind of know that cyberbullying is bad, trolls are bad, online comment sections are bad. I don't think the film actually goes that deeply into this.
I don't think it goes that deeply into it either. I think it took a good direction.
We all agree. Yeah, I think people will agree.
But there aren't a lot of films actually covering the sort of territory.
Yeah.
So I appreciated that.
The Samara Weaving character, her performance is good, but I found the way this character was written just so annoying. Like, the like always the cooler than thou action chick who always has a sarcastic cutting quip, you know, all the time because she's so cool and she loves cocaine.
Oh yeah, that was actually something I liked about this film. The way they're handled in video games. Obviously, you have a token that gets you your HP, your power up. They're different in this. For her, it's cocaine. And those scenes, while they were repetitive, were always funny. The same with the application to Radcliffe's character.
It just reverts to this really tired old stereotype where it's like behind the fiery woman, there's like this sad, crying little girl who's scared. Like it's such a bad cliche.
Oh, I'm
this film 100%.
I'm with you on the writing, but I do as before. I do believe the all the actors involved do elevate this, do bring a lot to it.
The actors are better than the script. Yeah.
I also appreciate there are a lot of films that attempt to cover video game territory, adapt video games. Most of them are very bad. A few are very good. I would refer to the Mortal Kombat movie. This isn't based on any video game, but it approaches visually and in terms of style, pacing, and plotting, video game dynamics better than other films, and I liked how that was generally deployed. It's a distinct style, which I don't think is perfected here, but I'm glad it was pursued, and I enjoyed it even if it did get repetitive throughout.
To me, we already have the perfect first-person shooter movies, and that's the John Wick series. They're just mindless kill shooting, and you know, like, look at how stylishly this guy's getting off popping off headshots. Like, John Wick epitomizes that, like, movie as video game thing. The first John Wick, at times watching some of the, like, the scene where he raids the industrial area to get the bad guy's son, was like, oh yeah, this is Call of Duty. This movie is very John Wick in the shootouts. It also kind of feels like the Crank movies. Again, it kind of feels like Scott Pilgrim. I just didn't find much of what it was doing to be that original. That was probably the biggest issue with it for me. If it felt fresh, I would be a lot more forgiving.
All right, it does something that the John Wick films do in parts but don't do for huge stretches, where you level up in terms of the boss levels, where you get more and more and more advanced in terms of people you have to compete with. It annoyed me in John Wick 3 how suddenly if you have armor, you have to get two double shots to the head and things like that, which were evocative of video game aesthetics, but this followed it better in terms of its pacing. But moreover, what annoyed me about John Wick, especially the first one, is that while they try to go for this whole boss level up, when we do get to the Michael Nyquist character, suddenly, John Wick is suddenly not as capable of dealing with it.
Agreed.
Whereas in this film, when you do level up and get to the further boss characters, they do give rationales and basis for them being harder to overcome, and I liked that about it. There was consistency to this that there wasn't in John Wick. Having said that, yes, even John Wick 3 was a better film in terms of its shooting style and cinematography style. I'll make that distinction there.
Yeah, and better choreographed.
Yes,
I just felt like the action in this, it felt too constrained. It should have worked better around its budget.
But there was also an intrinsic suspense in this film too. In John Wick, it's always he has unlimited bullets, but here, there is a ticking clock. He only has 100 bullets. What is he going to do with them? And I liked that.
Yeah, and I'll say something positive about the film. It is quite well paced, so there's an entertainment value to it just because of the ADHD stylings, I think. Yeah. Stuff's constantly happening. There are some twists in the plot you might not expect. It's a straight line in terms of the major end goals, but there are some nice bumps in the road along the way.
Yeah. What I would say is this. If a film where Daniel Radcliffe gets Harry Potter gets guns surgically attached to his hands with 100 bullets sounds like a good idea to you, then you'd go see it in the right crowd. I think you would enjoy this more in a Monster Fest. I'm not trying to plug the screening here, but I think
it's true. I think the crowd would really elevate it. I can see crowd participation lifting it and people really getting into it.
Yeah, it's on a Friday night at Event George Street, and
have
like you have a beer, go watch it. Like, if you're gonna watch it, go watch it in that crowd.
The thing about you calling him Harry Potter is, when I was watching this, I never thought Harry Potter. Daniel Radcliffe has reached the point for me where he's just Daniel Radcliffe.
Yeah, he's been in enough interesting, distinct features. Obviously, horns. We talked about Sir Simon earlier. He's moved on so much from Harry Potter, in the same way Robert Pattinson has moved on from Twilight. And look, he's Daniel Radcliffe's a good actor. Since Half-Blood Prince, he's been good.
He is good, but you mentioning horns, Swiss Army Man, and now this, it's funny, like, he still is always kind of a wizard, right? Like, he still always has some kind of fantastical ability in the roles he gets cast in.
But the best trick on that is Now You See a terrible film, but Now You See Me Too, where he's playing a magician.
Right.
Which was quite funny.
I never saw Now You See Me Too.
It's awful. But he has been very careful in not trying to be typecast and has gone for deliberately recent roles.
Outrageous roles.
Yeah, and this is certainly no exception. So it is screening in general release in March, but there is a screening from Monsterfest on Friday night. Lee Whannell's The Invisible Man starring Elizabeth Moss is in cinemas from tomorrow. And Fantastic Fest is screening until March 2nd at the Rand Regrets. And apparently, I haven't been there, but there's a Laneway cinema and they're doing screenings in the Laneway.
Yeah, the Randwick Ritz has had some nice upgrades recently. I think there might even be more cinemas, more screens coming. I'm not sure about that.
And that's what I've heard ever since it was purchased, that they're planning on, I hope this, as long as they don't get rid of the main beautiful Art Deco one.
Something crazy also happened today. The baboons. Tomorrow, the baboons, yes.
Yeah, they're out. At the time of reporting, they have been captured.
It's no Ad Astra situations. In your future.
Don't dire eyes for 28 days later. Everything's going to be okay.
But no, tomorrow United Cinemas Opera Keys open, supposedly.
Yeah.
But I'm looking it up now. I'm trying to see if there's session times. Dendy Opera Keys is no more.
Wow. But they are... Dendy Newtown is obviously still going. I think they're actually planning on bringing in a few new cinemas to the new Opera Keys location.
There are. Yeah, they are. Which is... talking about the Ritz reminded me. But yeah, apparently there's session times. Let's look this up. Invalid location. Please check your link. Okay, well, on the site, there's no session times up, but apparently it opens tomorrow.
Yeah, check that out. That'll be there for... it's been in the hub for quite a few festivals. The Sydney Film Festival, Sydney Latin American Film Festival, the Korean Film Festival.
Yeah, I really wonder how Sydney Film Festival is going to run if Dendy Opera Keys, or now United Opera Keys, doesn't allow them access, doesn't cooperate with the festival, because there aren't that many screens in the city. Actually, the bigger question is going to be, how is Sydney Film Festival going to run if the planned development at the George Street Cinemas Complex goes ahead and there's no cinema there on George Street?
Yeah, what are they going to do? Hoyts Palace Broadway, obviously has never had Palace a cooperative Central. Agreement. Well, Palace has never had a cooperative agreement with the Sydney Film Festival.
They've done some of the post-festival screenings.
Yes, that's true. Excuse me, that's true. So, but in terms of the festival proper, and... Furthermore, there are Hoyts, potentially. Yeah, there's a few...
But it would be way more scattered. The great thing about the locations now is that they're close by.
Close by, yeah. So that's something we'll be covering we'll in see. More detail come Sydney Film Festival and other festivals that are coming up later in the year. So yeah, have a wonderful night. Let us know what you want us to fight about.
Or morning or afternoon.
Whenever you're listening.
Even, you know, enjoy 4 a.m. if that's when you're listening.
Yeah, if that's... But yes.
Never know.
Have a wonderful...
Whenever. Have a wonderful life. It's a wonderful life.
It's a wonderful life. Good morning.
Evening.